afternoon and welcome to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, the Committee on the Economy. Please feel free to follow us on Facebook. We are the only committee with a Facebook page to make ourselves more accessible to the public. So today is January 23rd, 2018. I'm Senator Mia Costello. I'd like to welcome Senator Gardner. Welcome. Senator Meyer.
Thank you.
And Senator Stevens. Senator Machicki will be joining us as soon as he has another meeting that will be finishing up. Our recording secretary is Carrie, and the LIO operator is Ben. Thank you very much. Today, and it's also 1:40, we had a little bit of a late start due to some technical difficulties, so I appreciate my staff who's going to be holding the slides as we go along. Today we have Lori Wingheyer, who's going to give us an update on the state's innovation waiver. And this is something that the committee has been very interested in following, and I appreciate, Lori, you being here to give this update. Following your update, we will be hearing from the Pacific Northwest Economic Region on their what they offer to the state in terms of economic diversification. So with that, I would like to give you the floor and also welcome Commissioner Mike Navar, who is here to hear part of your presentation.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Well, this is kind of an exciting time because I usually don't come to this committee and say it all worked out and it worked out the way we hoped, and we saw some of the results that we hoped to see, and in particular for the individual market. For those that were not involved in the Section 1332 waiver, or even better, when it goes back into 2016 when we had the governor's bill, HB 374, which went through this committee and ended up what was the legislation that allowed us to do the reinsurance program and consequently the waiver. And so going back, the Affordable Care Act has one particular section, and it is aptly named 1332, that allows individual states some creativity or innovation in how they deliver the individual and the small group market to their consumers. We took advantage of this law, or this section, within the ACA to apply for a waiver to fund the reinsurance program. And because of the way we're doing this, we are on page 2, and I'm going to move to page 3. What can be waived? The benefits and subsidies, the marketplace and qualified health plans, certain respects, the individual mandate, and the employer mandate. What the state looked at was we reallocated premium tax credits to receive the aggregate value of those tax credits or subsidies to implement an alternative approach. And the alternative approach would be the reinsurance program. We are not, page 3, we are not allowed to touch the coverage. The coverage must continue to be affordable, at least as affordable as it was. The scope of coverage must reach a comparable number of residents. And we cannot increase the federal deficit. Page 5 now. So what happened? We did the reinsurance bill, and in 2017, the year after the bill was passed and the legislature appropriated $55 million to the program, we saw the market begin to stabilize, and the fact that the individual market only took a 7% increase. And I'm saying only because the prior 2 years we had seen close to a 40% increase each year. This year, with the reinsurance program, we actually saw an average decrease of over 24%. The silver plans did not go down as much as the other plans, simply because as the gold and the copper or the bronze, simply because the federal government, President Trump's, made the decision to not fund the cost-sharing reductions. Now, in not funding those, it did not mean that qualified residents, those in moderate to low income, did not receive the cost-sharing reductions. It just mean the funding had to come from somewhere else, and the plans that were loaded were the silver plans. So those plans did not see the reduction that the gold plans saw, or the bronze. Last year when we came down, we said we were in the process of the waiver, but the federal government, to give us the funding for the waiver, wanted to know that the state was going to live up to its portion of the reinsurance, which is about 15%, every year, and you appropriated another $55 million for the five-year period of the waiver. And these are calendar years, 18 through 22. The benefits for this are not just the high-risk claimants. The rate decreases are effective or applicable to every man, woman, and child, regardless of their age, where they live, or their health status. So this was a tremendous improvement in the condition, and we are no longer the highest health care insurance for the individual market in the state. Idaho, Nebraska, and Iowa are ahead of us, and depending on the plan you look at, so is Tennessee. Now, that's not...
Lori, I'm going to go ahead and take a brief at ease. Welcome back to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. We have Division Director Lori Winghire here to talk about the state's innovation waiver, 1332 innovation waiver update. And we do have a question from Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you help me understand again, Ms. Winghire, about the folks that have high-cost conditions? Now, what happens to them? They've been removed. What's happening to their coverage? And further, we list income, age, race, ethnic group, and other demographic characteristics. What are those other demographic characteristics? So the first question is, what happens to those folks in high risk?
Okay. Through the chair, Senator Stevens, when anyone who applies to the individual market right now is insured with Premera, and that includes the individuals that were in this high-risk pool. An individual goes to the doctor, they're diagnosed, or they have been treating for their lifetime, such as a hemophiliac or something that is truly a chronic condition. When Premera receives that claim, or any other insurer, if we were fortunate enough to get two insurers in the state, they then cede it or transfer it to the reinsurance program. So you as the consumer or the patient never know that you have been transferred. When you talk about what has been paid of your bills, what your premium is, what your copay is, who's in network, who's out of network, you're dealing with Premera only. So you really don't know what has happened to your claim, that it's been ceded to the reinsurance program, and that who's actually paying it in 2017 was the state, and in 2018 it's a combination of state and federal funds.
Yes, I think so. So those folks are still fully covered.
Yes, sir, Senator Stevens, through the chair.
And then, Madam Chair, the demographic, what does that mean? Other demographic characteristics?
Through the chair, again, there is no discrimination in this plan whatsoever. It doesn't depend if you were being treated at the Native Hospital, the ANTHC, South Central. It doesn't matter if you're being treated in the urban areas. It doesn't matter where you live. There is nothing in this plan that discriminates against any Alaskan who qualifies for the coverage to begin with. It impacts all of us in lower rates, but we still get the same breadth of coverage as far as the essential health benefits that you had before this program was set up.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Winghire.
And still continuing on page 5. We did not waive any aspect of the ACA that would reduce coverage to obtain these lower rates. So the essential health benefits and all that makes the plans rich, as one would call it, are still in the plans. What we did do was we waived the single risk pool, and what that basically says is that the high-risk claimants are being transferred or ceded to the reinsurance program. And we requested pass-through of the premium tax credits. So this, in essence, is how this works. Alaska was getting a huge amount of dollars for low and moderate income to pay for the premiums. When we did the reinsurance program, and the rates only went up 7%, or went up 7% in 2017, the initial projection was that they were going to go up another 40. So we basically had a 33% difference between what would have happened had we not passed the reinsurance program and had you not appropriated the $55 million and what the actual rates were. The federal government would have paid the premiums if we'd have raised it 40%, if we'd have raised it 80% for low and moderate income. So that money that they weren't spending, because the rates are basically subsidized, or they're, is coming back to the state. And our waiver, as you will see, over a five-year period, is an estimated $322 million to fund the reinsurance program.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gardner.
Thank you. Well done. I mean, were the elements of our 1332 waiver plan, were those your ideas, original ideas? Is there an organization that's working on these? Or is this all just homegrown?
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, this is homegrown. I have an incredible staff, and we brainstorm a lot on how we can improve things, uh-huh, or what we can do better, or how we can make an impact. And this is one of the ideas we came up with. We didn't know if it was going to work. We certainly didn't know if the waiver was going to come through. Uh-huh. But we were seeing the individual market so impacted that people were going without coverage. We had to do something.
Madam Chair, if I might.
Senator Gardner.
So are you aware of other states looking at what we have done here?
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, I believe on about three pages back, we have worked with at least 15 different states. And we know from our involvement in federal legislation over the past year that our model has been in almost every bill that's come out of D.C.
That's very impressive. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Binghart. And I think Senator Gardner was reading my mind, because that was going to be my question to you. Is I know in talking to you that you have been other states have reached out to us to find out more about how they can do the same thing that we're doing. And so is that are your counterparts in other states people that you work with regularly, and what are their comments on this plan? I mean, are they encouraged? They obviously are encouraged, but are many of the states actually introducing similar legislation?
Senator Costello, Madam Chair, yes, they are. There's some quirks in applying for a waiver. One, we had to have your authority to do it, and some of the legislators only meet every other year. And some are reluctant to do it because we paid the first year, you appropriated the first year, and the second year you appropriated for the term of the waiver. So we've got about 15% is our best guesstimate on what Alaska will contribute for this to be successful over the next 5 years. Other states are reluctant. Washington has a waiver out, and because their population is not as highly subsidized as ours, they're expecting to receive almost the reverse from the federal government. They're expecting to receive 15 and fund 85. So it just depends on what the state legislature wants to do and the governor, if they want to support this concept and if the funding is available, because you do have to have state funds. CMS has been very adamant and continues that there has to be some participation of the state to get the waiver.
Lori, I remember the legislation. I carried it, and mm-hmm. I remember conversations at the time where there were individuals who thought that the investment was a bailout. And can you reply to that characterization of this legislation?
Yes, and there have been comments that it was a bailout of the insurer. The insurer is still responsible. If we go over $55 million in claims for the diagnoses that were listed in the statute, there were 30-some conditions that when I brought the bill to you, we listed specifically. Mm-hmm. And if the claims for those are $60 million, the insurance company is still on the hook for those additional claims. We don't add additional money, and the consumers still have their claims paid. But it was not, we don't see it as a bailout of the insurer. We see it as being able to stabilize the market so that consumers could afford to participate. And so it does not, the money does not go directly to the insurer. There is a process. There was a large regulation process. We've got a plan of operation. We have a grant agreement with ACHIA of what their responsibilities are, so that this is pretty tightly controlled, but it's still having an impact.
Thank you. Senator Gardner.
Thank you. So would you say it is successful in trying to keep insurers in our market? I mean, I know we don't have them really, but they might have, even Aetna might have left without something like this?
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, I believed when we started this we would have another insurer in the market in 2019. I think we could still see that if we see some continuity or some a little bit more stability out of the federal government. Right now, the ACA is still so volatile with the change of administrations that insurers are reluctant to go into any state. But once that is decided of what is going to be, what the ACA is going to look like going forward, I expect we will see another insurer come into the state.
Thank you.
Thank you.
On page 6, we've got kind of a timeline, which I know you're familiar with because, again, this bill came before this committee, and many of you, particularly Senator Carsello, were with us when we took it back, when we got the financing. It went to House Finance. It went to Senate Finance. This was a concept that was new to this state of doing the reinsurance program. Would we see the benefit of it, and how would it look in the future? The timeline continues on to the next page where our waiver was awarded in July, and we received quite a bit of media over that because there were naysayers that said we would never get it approved because this was the first one of its kind. But I think through a lot of diligent keeping on, there were trips made to talk to CMS. We certainly talked to senators in D.C. and congressmen, that we received a lot of support. CMS came out with a public declaration that you should be basically doing it like Alaska. They wanted to see more waivers like Alaska. And in July, our waiver was approved, and a contract was sent for the governor's signature where we're expecting the $322 million. Right now, where we're at is we had to forward our open enrollment to CMS, and we're expecting that in the next week or so we'll know the exact dollar amount we're getting for 2018. Our projections still stand, as we don't think there'll be any discrepancy or very little discrepancy, and it's about $48 million coming in this particular year, calendar year 2018. So they sent us an email last week and said it would come in one payment. So we are excited to get that and be able to talk to you more about. But we don't expect there to be a great deal of change from what we anticipated. As I said, the waivers are not necessarily the easiest piece that we've ever worked on. And we probably, Oliver Wyman, who was the actuarial firm, we spent the $137,000 with them. We had another $17,000 with ICER for the economic study. And probably if you added up our bills from the Department of Law and looked at staff time, this was probably a $250,000 investment of the state to get this waiver, including the public hearings and the outreach programs that were required as a part of the application process. Page 9 shows you the excerpt from what was Secretary Price, or who was Secretary Price, that they welcomed the opportunity to work with states on waivers for high-risk programs or high-risk pools. And CMS did publish a checklist then in 2017, which we had a lot of input on, of how you could streamline this program to make it easier for other states. This is the news release that we got from CMS of our waiver being approved. And again, this was a good day for us. We were very pleased to see this come through. The next page shows, and I believe some of you have seen this page before, this is what we have used from day one. This is from the Oliver Wyman study that shows what would have been paid in premium tax credits. That's the baseline of $233 million. With the waiver, the anticipation was that there'd be $182. We went after that $51 million difference, and what we think we're bringing home is about $48 of it. The enrollment did not reach the 21,000 this year. We think we're at a little over 18,000. We think a great deal of that has to do, even though our prices have dropped, that a great deal of that has to do with the uncertainty of the Affordable Care Act, because there was so much in the press about the individual mandate going away, that the ACA was going to be repealed. Funding for any outreach programs was taken away. The navigators were funded at significantly less than they have received in prior years, and the enrollment period was shortened. There were 6 weeks instead of 12. Mm-hmm. We think all those factors led us to have a slightly less enrollment than we anticipated.
Laura, you had mentioned earlier in response to Senator Stevens' question that a consumer is not aware when they transition into this program, and yet you're talking about enrollment. So what triggers or what is the event that creates, you know, the situation where someone's actually participating in this program?
Sure. Just like, Madam Chairman, just like any employer-sponsored benefit program, you have to enroll or at least go in and note if you want any changes to your health care plan or your health care insurance every year. And generally that period is the end of the year. November 1st to December 15th is what it was this year. In prior years, it had gone out as far as January 31st to enroll for that year's coverage. So once you enroll, you're not transferred or ceded to the reinsurance program till you actually treat for the condition. Mm-hmm. So when you enroll, Primera doesn't know if you, because we do not underwrite and we cannot discriminate on pre-existing conditions, we don't know what that pool of people are going to look like. We don't know how many are going to have a chronic condition or have some sort of traumatic incident that's going to qualify them for the reinsurance program.
Thank you. Senator Stevens?
Are you on 11 now?
Yes, sir.
So can you tell us why the both the baseline and the difference in 8 years doubles? What's going on there?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, quite honestly, that's trending for medical inflation, for the claims going up, and consequently the premiums increasing. That was our projection prior to the waiver.
That's pretty scary.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
The next page, and you almost need to compare the two, is what we actually, it's a cut and paste from what we actually were told we're going to receive from the federal government. And as you can see, the total over the 5 years is 322. The amount is slightly different. We had estimated 51 million. They're saying 48. But it was relatively close to our projections as to what we would receive in the pass-through funding. So that is the amount we are anticipating each calendar year to receive over the next five to fund the reinsurance program.
Sure.
So we're on the media coverage.
Lori, since viewers right now unfortunately are not able to look at the PowerPoint because of the technical difficulties, can you just summarize, like, perhaps the total? I mean, this is a pretty significant page, and I thought perhaps
Absolutely.
That might be worth highlighting.
In 2018, we had anticipated getting $51.6 million from the federal government to fund the reinsurance program. The federal government's estimate was $48.3 million. Our reinsurance amount this year is slightly over $59, which leaves the state with a balance due, basically, of what we are going to contribute as a state, of about $11 million. And that $11 million stays pretty constant throughout this exercise. In 2019, we anticipated $55 million coming into the state, almost $56 million, and the federal government is anticipating $61. In the following year, in 2020, we anticipated $60 million, and the federal government is anticipating $65. 21, we anticipated $65. They anticipate $71 million. And in the final year of the waiver, we anticipated that we would see $69 million, and they came up with $75 million. So their numbers in four of the years were slightly more than ours, and in the first year it was just a little bit less. When the waiver passed, we had not just other states calling, but there was a tremendous amount of publicity on it. We heard from not only the local media, but certainly from Fox, the State of Reform, Politico, the Wall Street Journal, Healthcare Intelligence. The list went on and on of who we heard for, and I think some of you might have heard from them too, because this was interesting times. I mean, the states were basically, everybody wanted to go do it the next day. But they didn't realize that we had been working on it for almost a year to implement the program, and then the waiver itself, how long that took, what the details had to be. It wasn't just an application. The analyses from the actuary, ICER, on and on. It wasn't something you can just do in a day, not to mention the fact that there's a six-month waiting period that your waiver sits with the federal government from the time it's conditionally approved till you get final approval. They have it sit 6 months, which is hard for some states to grasp that you could have it for 2019. But if you're going to have it for 2019, it better be into the federal government very soon.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gardner.
So what's the rationale for that six-month delay?
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, it is just the way their regs are written, that once they hold it for public comment for 6 months.
Okay, so it's open for public comment, and it could potentially change.
That is correct.
Thank you.
We've provided you with a listing of the states that we have worked with. Minnesota and Oregon have both passed similar programs, and their waivers have been approved. Iowa and Oklahoma applied for similar waivers and withdrew their applications because they could not come to agreement with the federal government. Their waivers were slightly different than ours, but they both had reinsurance components to stabilize the market, and they have withdrawn. Other states continue to work on the legislation and the program itself. It has been a busy year for us in the administration as we have worked with our congressional delegation on the number of bills and that have come out to, if you want to call it, repeal, replace, amend the Affordable Care Act. And we think we've made a difference. And one of the bills that came, I mean, most of the bills that say you see our program, and in the bill that we think came probably the closest to being enacted or passed, we were grandfathered. And they gave us an additional period or year. So we were quite pleased with that we were grandfathered in for the term of our waiver. And again, I think it's just a testament to all of you that, you know, we have, our bill has been a part of every piece of legislation that has come out of D.C. as what should be done to stabilize the individual market. The application, which is a few hundred pages long, is available on our website, as are the letters of support that we received from constituents throughout the state. So I think it's, you know, we can sit here and talk about how did this really transfer or translate to your consumers. In 2014, if you were on a gold plan, and you were 55, you paid $887 a month. By 2017, you were paying $1,000 more, or $1,837 a month. While we haven't gone back down to the 2014 rates, the 2018 rates are $1,325. We see that again in a 35-year-old. We see it throughout the bands that we're looking at as far as age groups. In 2014, on a gold plan, you paid $486. By 2017, it was $1,059 per month, and this is per individual. This year, it's down to $763. So it's progress in the right direction, and we're pleased with starting to see the rates come down. We still have some work to do, and that's going to be kind of part two of where we take the healthcare system, but as far as insurance, we're starting to see the decreases that we had hoped when you took this bill. And that's kind of the end of my presentation. I certainly open for questions.
Well,
I feel like applauding.
Let's stand and applaud her.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. It was my staff and certainly you, I mean, that helped us get this through. This bill passed with almost unanimous support. It, you know, this was a team effort, and it was good for Alaska, and we're pretty proud to have brought it home.
Thank you. And I just want to say, and I've told you personally, too, your commitment to this issue and to making things better is just outstanding. And Lori has also come to my community on a Sunday and hosted a roundtable in a person's home. I mean, this is the level of commitment she has. And I have to say that I think what we're seeing here is the power of innovation. When you innovate and find new ways of doing things, this is what you can come up with. And it's actually a proud moment for the state of Alaska. We are top in a lot of statistics that we're not proud of, but this is one I think that it's just really good to hear this news. Mm-hmm. And I know that it was a lot of work to pass that legislation, but I think the fact that you are so credible was a part of that unanimous support that it had. So thank you.
Well, thank you, yeah. All of you, again. Thank you very much.
Are there any final questions for Lori? Senator Stevens?
I think you should have said we were grandmothered and not grandfathered.
Note taken. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. We'll take a brief at ease while we prepare for the next presenters. To the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, the Senate's Committee on the Economy. And today we have the pleasure of inviting the Chief Executive Officer, Matt Morrison, and also the Senior Program Manager, Steve Myers, from the PENWAR organization, Pacific Northwest Economic Region. And they're here today to share with the Labor and Commerce Committee what PENWAR does, and just looking forward to innovation and economic development, especially because we focus on that in this committee. So with that, welcome, and would you like questions during or okay?
Yes, during is fine.
Okay, sounds great. So if members have questions, just let me know.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm Matt Morrison, as she mentioned, from the Pacific Northwest Economic Region. And we have a short PowerPoint that I know no one can see, but you all have it. I know that all of you are familiar with PENWAR. It is a $1 trillion economy and an area that represents an amazing geography of Western Canada and the Pacific Northwest. And it was really Alaska that helped make PENWAR happen, because you can't get here except by going through Canada. And if you just look at this map, it's obvious that we need to be working closely together. So it's great for me to be here. It's amazing to be here on a sunny day in Juneau. It's just beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I love it. So we've been fortunate in our 28-year history to be recognized in both federal governments as a gold standard for U.S.-Canada relations, which I guess I should say are at a very challenging moment in our entire history, with NAFTA being renegotiated or shelved or whatever is going to happen. I think here in Alaska, we don't maybe recognize the benefits of NAFTA, because the two-way trade between the two countries is so large. The next slide here, $2 billion every day. It's really it's just remarkable. The two-way economic trade. And in Alaska, what we don't see that is impacted by NAFTA are TN visas, people that work in Alaska who might be Canadian and have visas that are based on NAFTA. That could go away if the president rescinds NAFTA. The agriculture has been a great benefit. Just in the PENWAR region, we've tripled the amount of trade between the two countries in the time that NAFTA's been in place. And I like to say that our economic watersheds flow north and south. So generally, we are each other's largest trading partners. There's a great deal of trade that goes back and forth. The next slide just shows Alaska's leadership here in PENWAR. And we've been very fortunate to have great leadership, not only now, but historically. Alaska's played a major role in this organization, and I'm very grateful for the leadership that Alaska has generated. Couple photos here. It was a kind of astounding to me that Secretary Kelly, when he was DHS secretary, actually asked to come and visit Penor in Seattle, and we had a nearly two-hour meeting with him talking about our cross-border efforts and what we've done to try to create greater disaster resilience for our economies. And I think that was the uniqueness of Penor's relationship with DHS has been that we're about the economic security of the region. DHS works with a lot of security folks, but we're one of the very few that are really talking about the economy and why economic resilience is so important in these trading relationships. And you know so well here in Alaska, you know, as we experienced an earthquake last night, that, you know, your food is coming from the port of Tacoma, and these shipping lanes are vitally important. And we've done a whole series of exercises to make sure that people in the state of Washington understand how important Alaska is and that the food connections are really a priority. We just recently, because of the prominence that the region has with DHS, we recently received two grants, and one of them is really specifically targeting the one of the great concerns that the Coast Guard has about cybersecurity and cyber resilience in the maritime shipping arena. So I took our board members last night out to go through a lengthy demonstration at the Alaska Marine Exchange with Captain Ed Page. And, you know, there are continuing issues that we need to address on the shipping. And with you may not know, but Maersk, very large, they had a breach and a hacking situation that had a serious impact to their entire shipping, and it cost them $1 billion. So what our grant is working with the maritime community to look at where do you report a cyber incident, where can you get resources to shore up your cyber plan. We're doing an extensive survey and a self-assessment for the maritime community to look at their own cyber resilience strategies. And this is important. A lot of, you know, it's a different world than it was 10 years ago. A great deal of shipping is on automatic pilot. So that's an important thing. The second one related to last night is how to utilize drones for post-earthquake assessment. Mm-hmm. And we are focusing on linear infrastructure. And what I'm hopeful to do is to engage our private sector that down in Washington State has a lot of drones. We have Amazon and Boeing, and they're really looking at how to utilize drones. And what we would like to do is develop protocols that can encourage the private sector to work with the public sector to look at all linear infrastructures as they are today, and then quickly after an earthquake be able to launch the drones and put on the emergency management maps and even for the public what's moved. If it's moved more than 5 centimeters, railroad tracks, telecommunications, and we're working also with university researchers with LIDAR technology to look at the steel inside of bridges. So they can actually, it's kind of like Superman, they can look right into the cement and see what's still sound and what might not be. The next slide is just the breadth and array that that Penwer, which, you know, it's relatively a small organization, but depends upon the engagement of our member jurisdictions and the horsepower that people put into the organization. So we have very active agriculture. It's not on here, but we have a cross-border livestock health with the state and provincial veterinarians looking at livestock health issues. I know that there's, you know, one of the things that has come up is the health of the porcupine caribou herd, which in Whitehorse they think is really in trouble. When I come to Alaska, it's just fantastic. So, you know, what being able to look at animals and how we maintain their health, especially in with public safety. Mining, we have Dave Tallarico, who is co-chairing the mining group from Alaska. The border is always a great deal of effort. And for the cruise lines, we, for the last 2.5 years, had a pre-clearance task force that has been the cutting edge in working on the pre-clearance initiative between the U.S. and Canada. So what this is to enable more seamless flow of legitimate tourism across our borders. The pre-clearance will allow train passengers, cruise passengers to be cleared once and then go across the border without, sometimes there's 3 and 4 inspections. With the energy and environment, our energy chair and minister task force has produced a legislative energy horizon institute, which has now educated over 240 state legislators and provincial legislators on the entire energy system, how it functions, how it's built, and how it's regulated. And this has been an initiative to help secure the resilience of the energy system in the region. I've talked tourism, transportation. I'll just mention that this coming week, the president will do a State of the Union address in Washington, D.C., and infrastructure funding will be a major part of that address.
And thank you. And, Matt, I just wanted to say that we've been joined by Senator Michiki.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator, welcome. And thank you, Madam Chair. And stop me anytime. I'm sorry to be droning on here. But the infrastructure is so important for sustainable economic growth. And I would say that what Penwer brings to the table in this arena, and I would be happy to take any questions on this, but a couple, maybe 5 years ago, we took our president, who was a senator in Idaho, on these tours, as we're doing today. And in both Saskatchewan, Alberta, and British Columbia, each one has a very small center of excellence that examines whether major infrastructure projects could be, should be, or, you know, public-private partnerships. And in Alberta, we heard about how they were able to design public school buildings and work with architects, engineers, and builders and save some $40 million by building 20 of these with the same design. Mm-hmm. We saw how they've used this for water systems, for transportation systems, and it's not just toll roads. That's the big message, is that public-private partnership is we're calling it innovative infrastructure funding. So utilizing that knowledge that in the provinces they've done over 200 public-private partnerships that have been very successful. I guess that's the next page. We set up a task force, and we've been working with our congressional delegation. And in the FAST Act, which is the Surface Transportation Act, 3 years ago, they authorized a very small program called the Regional Accelerator for the Regional Innovative Infrastructure Accelerator Program that would help municipalities and states first understand federal funding opportunities like TIFIA, and there's a whole alphabet soup of federal opportunities for funding. And it would also enable a state or a municipality or local, a borough, to look at could this project be done as a public-private partnership? What would it take to do that? And what are the benchmarks and guiding ways to make that happen? So we're hopeful after 4 years of working on this that the $12 million to this already was authorized, but now is in the appropriation if Congress does pass their omnibus budget bill. So it's gone through the House and Senate. And if that does come to pass, then we would like to apply to be a regional accelerator for creative infrastructure finance and use some of the methodology that we've learned and seen in Canada. So the next page just talks a little bit about what that infrastructure accelerator demonstration program is. We were happy that there's a bipartisan problem solvers caucus in Washington, D.C., which I thought was a great name. There are 24 Republicans, 24 Democrats in Congress on this, and it was one of their major recommendations that this should be funded. So we're hopeful that that will happen. And let me take a breath here and just on the infrastructure piece. I know that way beyond this little accelerator, it's being reported that the president will speak about infrastructure and, you know, how to leverage it, maybe the money that the federal government is going to put in for not only transportation but for a number of public projects. And I think that this is an area that we can learn a lot from the rest of the world. So let me stop there. We have a few other issues, but love to hear any comments, questions, on especially on the infrastructure or any of the trade issues.
Senator Stevens.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I really appreciate what PNR has done in terms of NAFTA. I guess I don't really understand where Congress is, that's $1 billion a year, and what was the amount the trade that goes back and forth between? No, that was nothing like that.
$2 billion a day.
$2 billion a day goes back and forth between Canada and the U.S. What's the possible benefit of doing away with that, of shelving it? It escapes me entirely.
Me too.
Okay, well, that's enough.
but let me just comment that it's very important to recognize that Congress does have a very clear say in what happens with NAFTA. And so up until this point, everyone's been kind of watching the USTR Lighthizer and the Secretary of Commerce meeting, and they're meeting right now in Montreal. But it is it's very clear, in according to the Trade Promotion Act of 2015, that Congress can request any information from the USTR about any trade agreement that's being negotiated, and NAFTA falls in that category now. So we've been asking our states to go ahead and consider asking congressmen to say, well, would you please tell me what the impact of a rescinded NAFTA would be on my state? At least that's an important message. So that's one of the things that we've been advocating, because we think there are a lot of unintended consequences to removing this trade deal.
Madam Chair, follow up.
Senator Stevens?
I think, I'm not sure if it was you, Matt, or someone else on your staff who was talking about the, so $2 billion a day across the U.S.-Canada border, but I was surprised to learn what Alaska's trade is with Canada. Do you have those figures?
Right? Yeah, it's on the $451 million in exports to Canada.
$451 million.
That's
pretty substantial for a small state.
Fourth slide deck.
Fourth slide?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, right here.
Thank you.
So, yeah, Canada's the fourth largest export market to Alaska, or Fort Alaska.
Oh, yeah. $451 million there.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Senator Gardner?
Just to that point, and bringing that to the attention of our delegation, are you confident that they are aware of the impact on Alaska, or do you think there's something we can do to make sure that they understand that?
Well, I think that I'm not sure that anyone is really aware of what a rescinded NAFTA, what the impacts would be. So I just know that in the authority that Congress gave itself, they reserved a lot of rights beyond what the Department of Commerce, the agency, has. And one of them is to be informed in throughout the process, before, during, and as the trade negotiations are taking place. So Congress has a lot of authority, mm-hmm. and I'm just encouraging them to use it.
Thank you.
Great.
Any questions on infrastructure?
No, I'm excited for you to talk about robotics and the impact on the workforce.
Okay,
sure.
Okay. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'll highlight a little bit of what Penmore is doing with our innovation track and some of the things we've done in workforce, university presidents, and economic development.
And Steve, if you don't mind introducing yourselves for those listening on Gavel to Gavel.
My name is Steve Myers. I'm the Senior Program Manager at Penmore. To kick things off on the slide here, we've been kicking around the challenges that we see in the region just with automation and robotics and the impact that they're having on our workforce and what the future holds when it comes to preparing our students for the future and what to be trained on. Pulled out a couple best practices that we've highlighted this last summer at our Portland Annual Summit. One of them was the Oregon Manufacturing Innovation Center. It's housed in Scappoose, Oregon, and it's more than just the Boeing company as the private sector partner with it. There's also five other companies. One of them happens to be Vigor, which owns the Alaska ship dock in Ketchikan. So this school is based in Oregon, but one of the innovative things that it does is it brings industry into the classroom and teaches students early on the importance of engineering into real-world programs and projects that they have. And so it's just getting started, and there's some real excitement and momentum behind it in the region. So just wanted to highlight that as a best practice that we've been showcasing around the region. And then one other piece of this, too, it goes into our skilled trades and apprenticeship programs that have been lagging in the region. Washington State just recently awarded $6.4 million to 11 communities to bolster our apprenticeship programs with the goal of about having 100,000 apprenticeships over the next 10 years in the state of Washington. There's been a big gap for the jobs that are needed and the actual workforce that's being trained in the state. So there's areas where, again, the state shows a big shortfall in the skill trades that they have and where they're missing. And also, beyond just workforce, some of the other pieces that I wanted to highlight were our Innovation Working Group, which Senator Costello co-chairs. We've looked at a lot of ways that we can collaborate better across the region when it comes to regional research, how we can work not only across states but also across the country as well. Just recently through the Cascadia Innovation Corridor, which is an initiative between Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia. Within that, there's a group called the Cascadia Venture Accelerator Network, where accelerators and incubators and research institutions within those states have agreed to have an MOU to work together, and this is also fairly new, so they're still looking at what that's going to be in the future, but it's a pretty impressive group of 50 organizations that have agreed that they are willing to work together to share resources when it comes to fostering innovation and helping startups and sharing research. So that's pretty exciting. And then to kind of wrap things up with our discussion on university presidents, so over the last, it's been almost 10 years now, we've had groups of university presidents from across the region actively come and attended our annual summits, meet and exchange best practices on university research, management, how we can, again, get our students better engaged and also give them the ability of a little bit more mobility. Those have come up in discussion as well. There's a lot of interest within the universities to start working outside their walls and also collaborate more where they can and any more when it comes to investment for research and that type of things. It's more than just asking, you know, what your organization has, but what partners you have and what you can bring to the table. And so that's caused a lot more of the universities to reach out for partnerships and that type of thing. So with that, those were some of the high-level innovation pieces. I don't know if you had any questions or highlights you wanted me to add on to.
Well, thank you very much. It looks like Senator Stevens has some questions.
Well, I know we did talk about the 15 university presidents, and I think it would be a good idea if the president of the University of Lassa participated. What would be the advantage of Jim Johnson being there in Spokane on July 22nd?
So, again, yeah, it's a real opportunity for Alaska to showcase what the university system here has, but then also if there's areas where they can see collaborating with other universities, bringing them in and involving. I know just with the drone project, we've heard the University of Oregon and Hawaii, I think, are also involved, the University of Alaska. So, again, it gives it gives the presidents those the opportunity to see who's working together and collaborating more. So the advantage there would be to not only be able to showcase what Alaska has to offer, but then also to learn from other legislators and education leaders of what's working well in their states or provinces.
Oh, very good. Thank you.
Senator Michiki.
I just had a question that's on the 15% other, what are the other types of people? I mean, it seems like most of the categories would sort of be filled, but.
Oh, at the summit?
Yes.
Okay. That's a good question. I think we have people from all walks of life that have attended. Sometimes it's local governments. We do have a lot of local governments. The NACO, the Association of Cities and Counties, meet with us. That would probably be an other here. But anyway, that's
you've perhaps, been perhaps it's spouses.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. I would just like to add to the workforce piece that having talked to Senator Hughes today earlier, that, you know, the opportunity in Alaska to really take hold of the new technologies of 3D and virtual reality, and where you have high large bandwidth to be able to bring the very best teachers into remote villages. I am just astounded at our last summit. We had this, they call it a hackathon, but they had all the gamers, the VR, AR guys, meeting with these blue-collar construction folks. And this is what I found fascinating, is you take two sectors that normally don't connect at all, like these gamers and the builders and architects, and the builders talked about what are their challenges that maybe these guys could have, and they came up with some remarkable solutions to issues in the construction industry. And I think that to me is the cutting edge of this innovation ecosystem that we're trying to build, is where are these pockets of high tech, and they usually are, they stick together, you know, like the gamers are really into this, you know, VR stuff. They're but having legacy industries meet with them and even in a weekend have a challenge. Just an example, I know it's hard to grasp, that the one that I was fascinated by was there was a major builder in British Columbia that builds hospitals. And they said, you know, they started on Friday night. One of our problems is, you know, we design these hospitals with all the best input we can get, but then, you know, once it's built, the doctors and the nurses, oh, we want to change this or change that. And it's the change orders that make things so expensive. So the gamers said, well, that's no problem. So in a weekend, and I saw it, you know, I put on the goggles and I walked through a hospital that had never been built. And wherever I turned, I could say, you know, lighting is not enough here, or we need more space here. And it got my work, my text got embedded in the plan, which was, you know, in the ether. And this architecture firm was so thrilled that in a weekend they had a product that they thought was going to save them, you know, and their clients millions and millions of dollars. Anyway, that's an example. I mean, it was like you were walking right. This is a six-story hospital, and I walked through. Anyway, so that's the innovation ecosystem that we have to bring to our communities. Every, you know, there are pockets of tremendous innovation in Fairbanks and Anchorage, and this can be, you know, spread now with the incredible tools that we have. And I think the possibilities for education are really endless of utilizing these tools. And you know, I didn't realize until my son showed, you know, the phone is the 3D goggle. You put it in the cardboard, which is $3, and all of a sudden you are in another world. You don't have to buy anything special. It's the phone and the apps that become the 3D experience. So it's very accessible. Anyway, I'm sorry, I'm getting carried away, but I think this notion of bringing the best and brightest young people and giving them challenges from legacy industries is so exciting. And that's what when the university presidents, that's my challenge to them. What are you doing to catalyze the innovation ecosystem on your campus? And I just think we're at the cusp of some amazing things, and I think the unique situation in Alaska, because of your distances, you can excel in things that other people will never think about.
Mm-hmm. Well, do we have any comments? You couldn't have said it better. I actually visited the hackathon, and it was fascinating because I saw firsthand the value of training, where you may invest a lot of money in training somebody, let's say, for example, to be an electrical line worker, but until you put those goggles on and you feel as if you're up there in that bucket, you know, 20 feet above the ground with, you know, with the pole, you realize that this may or may not be the job for you. And so virtual reality allows people to find that out at the beginning rather than after there's been an investment. And I just think it's, you know, it's really fascinating. And I really appreciate the fact that you came to Juneau and that you've had a lunch and learn, and now you're before the committee and you've been meeting with individual legislators. As you know, we have an innovation caucus that I co-chair with Representative Zach Fansler. Anyone's welcome to join. And I think that the power of innovative thinking cannot be overstated. And we heard earlier today our innovation waiver from the state, which is hugely successful. And now to follow up with you this afternoon has been wonderful. For those who are listening online who did not see the PowerPoint, we will post that so that it can be shared. And wanted to ask, are there any final questions of committee members? Okay. Well, seeing none, thank you so much for coming. And if there are any questions, members, just run it through my office, and we'll share it with Matt and Steve, and let us know how we can continue the collaboration that we're doing with the state of Alaska.
The year of innovation is next year?
I do have legislation naming the year of innovation, and hope that that get some legs.
Fantastic. Anyway, you know, Alaska is just, I hope, you know, in spite of the challenges with the budget, Alaska is the top of the world. And you know, if I just think there's so much amazing potential with the people of Alaska. And you know, the cultural diversity that you have, and the incredible, anyway, it's great to really see what it is that Alaska has to offer the rest of the world. That's what I want to say. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you. And the meeting is adjourned.